Mavis Gallant published her first short story in The New Yorker in 1950, and since then, the Canadian writer has had over 100 stories in that magazine. She's received Canada's most prestigious literary prize, the Governor General's Award for Fiction, and in 2004, she was awarded the Pen Nabokov Award for Lifetime Achievement. Tonight, at Symphony Space, she and her work will be celebrated in a special program of selected shorts with Russell Banks, Jhumpa Lahiri, Michael Ondaatje, and Edward Hirsch. And I'm very pleased that it has brought Mavis Gallant to my show today. Hello. And this is a rare visit to New York, isn't it?
Yes, it's the first in 9 years.
You grew up in a bilingual environment.
I was put in a French school very young, at four, as a boarder. This was in Montreal.
So you didn't learn...
But my parents were English-speaking, yes. My father was British.
But what was the first language you wrote in?
English.
Really?
Yes, it was English. Not when I was in school. I had to write in French there, but English was always... There's one language that chooses you if you have to. You don't choose it. You know, you don't say, I'm going to write Portuguese. If Portuguese wants to come in, it'll come.
Well, you've lived in France for much of your life, so I assume that even though you choose English, French is the language you live most of your life in.
It's my daily life is French, because it would be pointless to insist that it be English. But... if you're talking about writing, you know it arrives. You know all that by itself. Well, it arrives in English, even if I'm writing about French characters.
But I wonder whether the knowledge of another language as intimately as you know French affects your English. I would assume that Joseph Conrad wrote the kind of English he wrote because Polish was the other language.
Mm-hmm.
People who only write English, only live in English, I'm sure write differently than people who have another language there also living with it simultaneously.
Well, it's different. It's like two railway lines, and they mustn't touch.
You started writing as a reporter, didn't you?
That's right.
Had you wanted to write fiction?
Oh, I always was writing fiction. I had to earn a living.
Uh-huh.
And I always made sure that I had congenial jobs.
So you worked for the Montreal Standard.
That's right. I was there from age 21, and I resigned at age 27, 28, I went to Paris.
And what kinds of stories were you covering? Well,
I did features mostly.
So you had a chance to work on style. It's different than if you were just doing straight reporting.
On Saturdays, we had to do straight reporting, in which I was absolutely incompetent. I went once to the launching of a ship. I went to the wrong part of the harbor. I came back, and one of my colleagues, you know, who was a straight reporter, wrote the thing, and she said, the giant ship swaying slightly slid down the ways. And I said, I would not write that sentence. And it didn't sway. I'm sure it didn't sway. And she said, listen, it swayed.
Well, that's, in a way, that's typical journalese.
Yeah.
But do you think that being a reporter allowed you to pay more attention to detail, made you a better
observer? Absolutely. And I think it was... It's an attractive way of life. You know, you can just go home and say, I'm going to do some research, and go home and listen to Ella Fitzgerald records, and so on. But it brought me, what I really wanted was to see a number of backgrounds and to see all kinds of people and how they lived and so forth. And as I suggested my features most of the time, I would think of them myself. And they would let me do it as long as there was no criticism of a church or the royal family.
I see. But I wonder whether these stories then inspired the invented stories.
They come into my work even now in an odd way, yes.
Things that I covered.
Not
Montreal
so much,
50
not
years
Not so much the what actually happened, the trial or this or that. No, it's the houses. And coming into a house, and someone's house, and feeling the atmosphere, I was very fascinated by that.
How difficult was it for a female reporter in the 1940s?
It was appalling. They didn't want the girls. And you did feel that they were rejected. And I remember at one point, can I tell you an anecdote?
Of course.
Well, we had decided to have a press club, and the English-speaking papers, because they did that. And we were together, we were all together in this. And the men had a secret meeting excluding the women and excluded us. And then we were told, and I remember, think I must have been about 24, and I thought, they don't like us. And it had a great effect on me.
And that came as a surprise?
Well, I never thought about, you know, you might as well say collies don't like German shepherds. I mean, it's, you know.
No longer the case.
But I
suspect you're not going to go back into journalism.
I said
now the situation for women is a lot different.
Oh, it's completely different, yes, yes.
My guest is Mavis Gallant, who's being honored tonight as part of Selected Shorts. That's at the Symphony Spaces, 6:30. For more information, you can visit our show page at wnyc.org. There are also two volumes of her stories that have recently been reissued by the New York Review of Books, one edited by Russell Banks, the other by Michael Ondaatje, and both of them will be participating in the event tonight. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So what inspired you to pick up and move to Paris?
Well, I had it in mind from late adolescence. I wanted to go and live. But you know, there was a war on. This is during the war I'm talking about, Second World War. And I wanted to live in Paris. And I wanted.
So you moved to Vichy, France?
Well, no, the war was on. France was occupied.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't going to Vichy, France during the war. There was no question of my going over. But eventually, that was what I wanted. And I wanted to live there, and I wanted to do nothing but write fiction, of which I'd done very little and very scrappily. And that's that. And be published in English, of course, because of that.
Did you have a backup plan in case you didn't make it as a writer?
No, it never occurred to me. It never occurred to me.
I'm sure it never occurred to you that you'd have lived there as long as you have either.
I didn't have a plan. My plan was what I've told you, to get over there and write.
Was it easier to be a single woman in Paris than it was in Canada?
I wouldn't have tried in Canada. I was married and divorced.
Mm-hmm. You were married in 43, divorced in 48.
I wouldn't have tried it in any English-speaking country.
Do you feel Canadian still, even though you've lived in Paris for over 50
years? I am Canadian. I'm not something else. It's my passport. It's you know, you're handed out certain cards when you're born, and that was when I was handed, and I've kept it.
Well, what about Paris? Well, at a certain point, do you feel that it is totally your city, just as though you were born there? Or will it always be the place you came to?
Oh, not born there. You know what counts is where you first went to school. It's the first years of schooling that settle what you're going to be, I think, what you're going to think.
So when did you first start publishing your stories? I know you. The first one was published before
you're
you moved to
France. You're talking about New Yorker stories.
Or publishing in general.
Well, if you count newspaper work, age 21, yes. I had published of fiction two little scraps in a literary magazine, one of those magazines that if the typist goes out of town, the magazine folds, you know. And that was it.
And then you sent a story to The New Yorker and they published
it? I sent a story to The New Yorker. It was just on the first page of the story, the address of my newspaper and my name. And they sent it back, but with a letter saying, have you anything else you can show us? So I sent another story, and they took it. And
wow. That's the way to begin.
Well, somebody said to me in Canada, but you didn't seem surprised. Well, I was and I wasn't, because I'd planned to show them three stories anyway. And I remember being very happy with it, yes.
And then you moved to France.
I moved to France. I went down to New York and met William Maxwell, who was to be my editor for 25 years. And he took it for granted that what I was doing was all right. You know, that it was not a stupid idea.
Wasn't your career almost sabotaged early on by a crooked literary agent?
Oh, yes. Well, I'll tell you how it happened. I was living in Europe, and I was absolutely ignorant of the rules about agents. I didn't know that that you didn't sign an agreement with an agent. It was, you know, word of mouth and like that. And I thought, I had when my first story appeared in The New Yorker, I had letters from people and from this agent who called himself Jacques Chambrun, but it wasn't his name at all. He was American. And, you know, would I like to have him, who's handling everything? And I thought it would be a good thing because I was at that point in Salzburg. And I thought, I'm going to be moving around a bit, around Europe, and this is someone who can just do everything. So I said, all right. He made me sign an agreement for 5 years. I didn't know I shouldn't do that. And I went to the USIS library, you know, the big American libraries they had after the war.
U.S. Information Service.
Yeah, that's it, in Salzburg. And I looked up, there was a book called The Artists and Writers Yearbook. And I looked up agents, and I saw he was listed. But I didn't know that this didn't mean anything. And I'll tell you what he did. He sold my stories and kept the money and told me nobody was interested in my work. And I, at that point, was in Madrid and broke. I was selling my clothes at the Gypsy flea market, you know, outside. It was 1952. And I didn't know why suddenly they didn't like my work. I was puzzled.
So how did you discover that The New Yorker was, in fact, accepting your stories?
Because in the USIS library, where I went to, when you're broke, you go to a library and read what's free. You know, you just sit there reading. And I saw a New Yorker, and there was a story of mine in it. So I wrote to the New Yorker, to William Maxwell, and said, why didn't you show me the proofs? Because you made a couple of changes I don't agree with. And his letter began back, thank God we know where you are, because your agent told us you lived in Capri. And that you had general delivery as an address because you didn't want anyone to know where you lived. And, you know, you can only reach her through me, so give me the letters and I will. And, of course, they didn't do that. There was more than one story, and Marilyn wrote, said, did you get the money for this, this, and this? And it was my first encounter with barefaced cheating. You know?
But to me, the surprise is that you didn't ask about the money at the beginning. You asked about changing the story.
Yeah, that's true. That's what I wrote about. I didn't say, where's my money? I was very annoyed that they'd make changes I didn't like.
So have you been able to correct those stories with later publications, or are they the kinds of stories that you don't want to have collected anymore?
No, I don't really remember. They would be in a book called The Other Paris, and I really don't. I can't tell you. I don't remember.
There have been so many stories published. Do you go back and see some from the early days and say, "Oh my, what was I doing?" Or are you pleasantly surprised?
It can be both, a bit of both, but very often I can see what had influenced me at the time. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't see that, anything like that, no.
My guest is Mavis Gallant, who's being honored tonight at the Symphony Space as part of Selected Shorts, a special celebration that begins at 8:30. And if you want more information about that, you can visit our show page at wnyc.org. There are also two new publications of collected stories, Paris Stories, which were selected with an introduction by Michael Ondaatje, pretty good Canadian writer in his own right, and The Varieties of Exile, which is selected with an introduction by Russell Banks, both published by New York Review Books. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Mavis Gallant, who is being celebrated tonight at the Symphony Space, beginning at 6:30, as part of a special Selected Shorts. And among the people who'll be participating are Russell Banks, Jhumpa Lahiri, Michael Ondaatje, and Edward Hirsch. Also, a couple of new collections of some of the great stories of the past by Mavis Gallant. Varieties of Exile, and also Paris Stories, both being published by New York Review Books. So what do you like about the short story form? What makes a short story great in your estimation?
I don't know, but I know that when I get an idea for one, it comes complete with its own length. I've only published two novels.
And a play.
Yes. And when there are series of stories with the same characters, you can take it for granted that began as a novel. And that I thought, why do I need padding? These are the important things in it, as they are in one's life. You know?
So you call it padding. Others say that the reason they like the novel form is because they can digress.
They can what?
Digress.
Well, who wants to digress?
Well, that's part one way of telling a story is to digress. Another way is to get down to essentials, and you prefer the getting
but I've,
to
I've
the
nearly,
essentials.
But any novel I began to do since, it would get up to there, and I would think, well, this, and this is what this man is involved with. Take them out.
Mm-hmm. You've said that a short story is what you see when you look out the window. It can't encompass more than that, or it's not a short story anymore.
Well, there has to be a framework, and that would be what you see when you look out the window. But, of course, there's more that you will put into it.
Well, obviously. What does get a short story going? Is it an image? Is it just an idea,
me,
a newspaper article?
For me, it's an image. It's true. It's an image like a still in a movie. Or I've written this. It's like a stage when the curtain goes up, and you don't know yet what the people are going to say, what the characters are going to say.
At the end, does the author know more than the reader does in a short story?
Well, you shouldn't ever withhold information in fiction. And that's the sin against the Holy Spirit, I can tell you.
Do you think there's more tension in a short story than there is in a novel because...
Well, inevitably. Mm-hmm. Inevitably. But, you know, they're not opposed forces.
But the trick also is making a story really full, even though the focus is small. And you've been doing that brilliantly for a very long time. Mm. Do you have theories, or is this something that's just intuitive?
Well, I think it's just the way I write.
It's totally... Do you find it difficult to describe your writing process?
Yes, I do. I'm a bit stuck here.
Well, I won't ask you.
No, I mean... I'm
sure you sit down, you say you have this image, and then you write
the image,
a sentence, and then a second sentence
I know who
comes.
They are. Let's put it that way. It's as if you were given a photograph of people you've never seen before, and they're doing something, getting down from a train, anything, and you happen to know all about them. You know their names, you know what they do for a living, you know all that.
Because they're people you really knew or extractions from people you knew?
No, if they were, I only recognize it when I read it in print. And I think, oh.
Yeah. At the back of my mind, there was Mary.
Something. I must have been Mary. It'd be more likely like that.
What about the two novels and the play? What tempted you to stray from the short story form?
Because they strayed.
Mm-hmm. You just found yourself... something bigger
than
you had thought?
There was more than, yes.
And then you also wrote a biography of Alfred Dreyfus.
No, I didn't finish it because there were a number of reasons. But I did about 10 years research. I had been asked by a publisher, and I worked on it for about 10 years.
And why do you think Alfred Dreyfus would be a good subject? Because he was an
outsider? Oh, I didn't. I was asked to do it. Mm-hmm. I was asked to do it. And I remember I read the whole thing in the encyclopedia. And I thought, this is a wonderful fresco, you know. And I thought I could do it in 2 years. Mm. At 2 years, I hadn't even written a word. I was still collecting. But I was fascinated because what it revealed of France. And I felt as if I'd been sitting next to a silent TV and I'd turned it on.
I was reading more into it than that. I saw him as an insider who's an outsider. And to some degree, I would see your life in the same way. I mean, a lot of critics have found themes of exile in your work.
Well, I don't, because I was so cross about that once that I took the collected stories and I put the different categories and added them up. And there are no more stories about exile than anything else.
But living in Paris has given you the opportunity to write from the point of view of someone who...
I'm not an exile. I'm not a political exile. Mm-hmm. I went there because I wanted... I was free. Start with that, please. I was free. I could go where I wanted.
That isn't what I meant. I mean, since you, as you say, you are the person who comes from the place you were born in and grew up in, then if you choose to live somewhere else, you still are, you have this odd situation where you can know everything about that place, but you still bring another sensibility, an observer's sensibility to the place.
You're talking about Paris?
Yes.
Yes.
And which I would think would be an ideal situation for a writer.
But I've been there a long, long time. There are families where I have known literally five generations. But that means newborn children, mm-hmm. and the great-grandmother, you know.
Well, starting at the age of four, you were sent to boarding school and ended up going to quite a few of them. So I'm doing playing too much the psychologist here. You don't see any of that as leading to some of the themes in your stories?
Some of the early stories, probably.
You once identified the tension between rebellion and resignation as a theme in your work. Do you think that's something that almost everyone struggles with?
Well, it's certainly something that I recognize.
Because that's something that happens to a writer. Mm-hmm. You write a thing and then people start reading stuff into it, and then you have to try to figure out...
Inevitably.
What really is there. Mm-hmm. What about the Lynette Muir stories? Lynette Muir?
Well, Lynette is...
Lynette.
I'll tell you, is as close to autobiography as I've ever written, but it's only close, it's not it. And I gave her that name because Mavis is the song medieval name for a song thrush. And I wanted a bird name, and there are only two in English. They're Lynette and Merle. And I wasn't very fond of Merle. And it begins with M, and then they would say, oh, that's, you know, herself. But Lynette was,
So.
And some people understood it.
Mm-hmm. Got the bird thing.
Caught it, yes.
Well, in the end, as you say, it's only mildly autobiographical. On the other hand, isn't all writing autobiographical on some level?
Because you are bound to be, to some extent, able to put yourself in someone else's place. That's the difference between fiction and journalism, because in journalism you have no right to put yourself in someone else's place at all. You're a bad journalist if you do that. But with writing, you can easily... I write a lot about men, or from men's point of view, and for years I always gave those stories to a man, any man, to read and say, is there something there a man wouldn't do? Or say, to make sure.
And how often did they say?
Once. One said, he gave me back the story, and he said, I've never seen a guy do that. Mm-hmm. And I don't even remember what it was. And I went home and cut it out with scissors. That's all.
Because I think that even though men and women do think differently on some level, they understand the way... I mean, I've spent more time trying to figure out what women were thinking than practically anything else I've done in my life, and I think I could probably write a very credible story from a woman's point of view.
How would you get, then, how women talk to each other when there's no men around?
Because I've overheard women talking to each other.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. Not aware that mm-hmm. I was there, or not concerned that I was there. Mm-hmm. How do you do it? Men talking to each other.
Well, I have overheard too, but I'm careful with it. I don't do it much because the sensibility is not the same at all.
As I understand it, Jane Austen never wrote a scene between two men alone.
No, she really couldn't.
But you feel comfortable writing from a man's point of view?
Yes, it's interesting because it is different, and it's really from a distance.
Mavis Gallant's being celebrated tonight at the at Symphony Space, a celebration of Mavis Gallant with special guests Russell Banks, Jhumpa Lahiri, Michael Ondaatje, and Edward Hirsch. And it's co-sponsored by the National Book Foundation of New York, Foundation, the New York Review of Books, Penn, and the Virginia Quarterly Review, publication she's been involved with. In fact, the New York Review Books has reissued two collections of short stories with new introductions by Michael Ondaatje and also Russell Banks. Jim Lahiri, who's going to be there tonight, says that you cites you as a major influence. She you can see it in her first collection of short stories, The Interpreter of Maladies. She even shares some themes.
What do you mean?
What do you mean? What do I
mean?
Yes.
What was it that made you think that?
I saw certain themes that that were similar to your work. Do you think about that? Do you think about? Do you read young writers and?
Yes, but not things that are sent to me. The dreaded envelope, the dreaded beige envelope. No. But
please, could you comment on my work? I mean, that sort of thing. I've written something, and I wonder if you would...
I don't read it in that case. I returned it unread.
Earlier this year, there was a documentary about your life and work on the Bravo channel called Paris Stories, The Writing of Mavis Gallant. Do you enjoy the attention that your work has been receiving recently?
Yes.
Yes. Well, we hope it all will sell books. Or is
well,
something
apart from that, that's another thing. But it's very nice at the age of 84 not to be forgotten.
Well, I mentioned your influence on Jim Lahiri. Maybe you didn't see it, but do you ever see the influence of something you've done on a younger writer?
I'm not aware of it. I'm more apt to see something else that's influenced a younger writer.
See the influence of a different writer altogether. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until you were very well established that you started to gain some recognition in your home country, in Canada. Why do you think that is? Is it because you don't live there? Do they not really see you as Canadian?
Oh, no. I was the first 30 years of what you can call a career,
they didn't publish you.
No, but... I have never myself tried to find a publisher, so why?
Well, I would imagine a Canadian
publisher
would have...
No, I don't mean why to you. I mean why rhetorically. You know?
What were your influences? Do you see your influences being mostly Canadian?
No, I don't remember reading any Canadian writers. I don't think there were very many. I read some, but I don't remember being influenced. They were French writers, Americans, and British. That I read a great deal of.
You've been compared to a Canadian writer, Antonin Maillet. Do you
really?
Think
that,
yes.
Totally different.
And also Alice Munro, and I wondered whether the similarities are simply that you're both Canadian women who write short stories.
I think that's all. And I think she would say the same thing, yes.
Do you write every day still?
Yep.
And do you find yourself writing about different things, or are there certain things that... certain themes, because that old idea that a writer writes the same thing again and again and again.
Well, it's hard for me to say. I'm actually editing my journals, and because they will eventually be published in Canada. So I'm busy with that. Great deal.
Have you been keeping journals all your life?
All my life, but I destroyed them twice. Once at 18, I was living in New York, and I went to Canada, and I destroyed my journals that I'd had.
Do you regret that?
No. And
why did you destroy them?
Because I wanted a new life.
Oh.
And then between 18 and 28, I was working in Canada, and I destroyed them when I went to Europe because I wanted a new life, 28. And then I've been keeping them pretty well ever since.
You have a journal for each year, for each decade that you have spent in France.
Well, the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. Less now that I'm rereading them because you lose the desire to record anything of your life. It's so just there.
But it's interesting that you destroyed them because you wanted to create a new life. To some degree, isn't that what writing is always about, creating new lives?
Well, it's other people's.
Yeah. And is that part of the excitement, that you can become another person for a time?
No, I stay out. I stay pretty well outside, yes.
You don't become the person
you're
writing about?
No, because if I became
about?
The person, we would be seeing each other, and that would be schizophrenic. It would be...
some people do. They say it's almost like method acting. You become the character that an actor plays.
That's different.
But You think. Would you prefer to be the observer?
I've never been an actor, so I don't know. But I would not inhabit a story or think that these people were real. That is more than imagination. I would think that was loony.
Mm. Some writers like to create characters to try to understand the way someone else might think about something. If you write about a serial killer, you don't have to be a serial killer, but
no.
Part of the fascination is trying to
but
figure
I
out what that would
be like. But I would
not
write about a serial killer. First of all, I've never met one. And apart from that, I would not understand anything about him. There could only be someone in the story trying to understand him and making a complete fool of himself in the process.
Mavis Gallant will be honored tonight as part of a special celebration by Selected Shorts. It's at 6:30 p.m. at the Symphony Space. For more information, you can visit our show page at WNYC.org. And then these two collections of stories that have been selected and introduced by, in one case, Russell Banks, whose collection is called Varieties of Exile, and Michael Ondaatje's is Paris Stories, both published by New York Review Books. I'm assuming that you're very pleased with the stories they've selected and the things they've said about you.
I love both books, yes.
And obviously these two writers
and the writers
admire you
and
as
the writers,
well.
They're wonderful.
And they will be part of the celebration tonight, mm-hmm. along with Jhumpa Lahiri and also Edward Hirsch. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.